This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
We're going to be looking at what flavours are and how we categorise those different smells based on where they come from. We're then going to have a look at more detail, looking at things like the types of wines that are in the WSET Level 3 exam and how to utilise that information to help you in the exam. Tips for blind tasting and how to improve your sense of smell so you can go into any exams or smell wines and have a lot more confidence in what you're smelling. So that's the key idea of what we're going to cover here. So let's start off with what flavors are. Flavors are just molecules. They're just chemicals that our olfactory bulb, which is the little bit of brain matter just above our nose, can detect. What happens is molecules will go up our nose or down our throat, up through the back into the olfactory bulb. There's receptors that create an electrochemical response in our brains that we then perceive as flavors. So you want to think of it a bit like a door with a key. One of those molecules has a key. It goes into a particular lock in our olfactory bulb, and then the brain gets the signal that this is pear or citrus or something like that. The intensity of the aroma that we perceive in our nose or our mouths, because let's face it, if it goes in our mouths, it just goes down the back of our throat up to the same place, the olfactory bulb. So they're very, very similar. But the intensity of the aroma is a mixture of the number of molecules that have been boiling out of whatever we're smelling and the sensitivity to that molecule. So we all have different threshold levels. Sometimes people are very sensitive to certain smells. Some people are less sensitive to certain smells. Some people have big holes in what they can and can't smell. So we are all different, and our intensity that we get is governed a little bit on those differences. There are also some really, really unusual people who get really confused between smells and color and sound, and they all become intermixed. So you might hear a sound and think it smells of green. No, that's not right. Actually, that's pretty good. But quite often, to some people who suffer from this thing called synesthesia, they might see a color and think it has a particular smell, or they might have a particular smell and hear something. So basically their senses are getting intermixed, because things like smell, sight, hearing, these are very core primeval functions in our brains. And some people, they're just wired up differently. Now, the smell you get could be a single molecule. You know, think of a key in your olfactory lock, so to speak. So a single key goes in there and you get the smell of pear. But it could be a group of keys creating a smell. So the analogy I like to use is the analogy between a note on a piano, ding, 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 ding. And when you put three or four notes together, you get a chord that creates a richer sound, and it sounds different to any individual note as well. Well, in smells, you have single notes, ding, 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 but you have a thing called an A chord, where you might get 2, 3, 4, 10, whatever number of smells that create this additional smell that you can't smell by itself. For me, it's a difference between purity of smell versus the richness that you might get, perhaps. The other thing is that some molecules are heavier and some are lighter. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means all sorts of weird things happen. Some of the smells might last for a shorter period on our palates and on our senses, and sometimes the smell or taste will last longer. Some of the times you won't notice it until you've warmed something up. Sometimes one of the smells, or you know, the chord, part of it will fade very quickly, so all of a sudden you go from smelling one thing to smelling something else over time, as different notes fade in and fade out, and notes that were hidden suddenly become more obvious to you. So smell is a temporal thing. It has a time element to it as well. So when you put it in your mouth and you swirl it around and spit it out or swallow it, whatever you're doing, there's a difference between just doing that and then waiting 10 seconds and seeing what happens, because things change. Also, our palates adapt. So if you get a really strong hit of something, over a period of time, you won't be able to notice it as much. So you'll get other flavors coming up as well. So smelling and tasting are not just in your mouth, swallow it, and then off you go, or stick it up your nose and swallow it. You can actually get a lot more out of it by playing with things like temperature, time, concentrations, all sorts of wonderful things. And we'll talk about that on how to approach smelling wines and tasting wines later on. As I said, we do have different thresholds that detect different levels. So some people are very sensitive to, say, cork taint, and they'll smell cork wines in bottles that I can't smell, or I might smell them in wines other people can't smell. I might smell blackcurrant at a certain threshold, so I'll go, oh, this wine's got lovely blackcurrant, and then someone's threshold is higher and they can't detect it, and they'll go, what blackcurrant? Sometimes if you warm a wine up, things become more volatile. So when you smell something, all it is a molecule that's boiled out of the wine, if you like. It's become volatile and you've hoovered it up. If you can heat the wine up or cool it down, you'll get different molecules and different intensities coming out of the wine as well. So one of the things it's quite good to do is actually taste the wine in your mouth, where your mouth warms the wine up and you sometimes do get different heavier flavors. When you take the fact that we all have different thresholds, the way you taste the wine is all different, and then you add on cultural preferences, you land up with people going, oh, I love that smell, and someone smelling exactly the same thing and going, oh, that's disgusting. There's some smells like rotten eggs that in some cultures are considered very, very nice, and in some cultures they're considered disgusting. So there's a genetic trait, and then there's your nature or your nurture, your upbringing, that will have an influence on the smells, on whether you like them or not. Thankfully, most people generally agree with most smells, but there's some dodgy rotten fish that's made in some countries that I just wouldn't be my cup of tea, I can tell you. But to those countries, lovely. As I said earlier, we've got different strengths and different weaknesses. Most of our core kit, if you like, is genetic. And over the years, over the millions of years of human evolution, we've got better at sight and sound and not so good at smell, but still it's a very, very powerful thing. And some people have got missing receptors, so they can't smell certain keys, if you like, which means that when you have a chord, a mixture of different notes, it'll smell different to them as well. So, as I said, smells have a very primeval sort of influence on our brains. And it's been shown that odor is actually really important for compatibility of one's partner. Or there's been recent studies showing that people actually choose their partner based on the odor. They're not consciously aware of it. They just do find a compatibility with certain people with certain smells. Now, it is easier to get better. Smelling is like any piece of physical activity that you do. The more you do it, the better you get. And it's even easier than learning to read or write in another language, for example. You know, genetic evolution has made us good at smelling. It's literally in our genes. So we are good at it. It's just that as humans, we don't tend to rely on it very much. And if you just change to a nose first type of policy, where you use your nose a lot more, all of a sudden you get really, really good at it. Also, if you can increase your vocabulary skills, that can help a lot as well. We'll talk more about how to improve your smelling later on. Now, WSET, Wine Spirit Education Trust, and many people in the wine trade often categorize smells by the general style and where the smell comes from. In fact, the WSET Level 3 exams are selected to show up to three different types of characteristics that you can get in smells. So we categorize these into primary, which are the flavors from the grape, secondary, flavors from winemaking, and tertiary flavors, which are flavors from aging the wine. With each category, primary, secondary, or tertiary, we also tend to group them together. These might be because they're all floral flavors, they might be all herbal aromas, or they're just using similar winemaking or aging processes. This grouping together in WSET speak is known as clusters. So you'll see things like floral clusters, red fruit clusters, oak clusters, deliberate oxidation clusters, etc. Now, when a flavor comes from multiple groupings or clusters, such as floral, red fruits, black fruit, oak, things, then we can say that the wine has complexity. A simple wine would normally have flavors from, say, one or two clusters. So it might be all red fruits or all red fruits and a little bit of floral or something like that. Whereas we say wines with more than three clusters can have quite a bit of complexity. And It doesn't mean, for example, I could say the wine's got red cherry, strawberry, red berries, red currants, etc. And they're all from the red fruits cluster. You can give lots of descriptions, but you wouldn't say that the wine's complex. There's only one cluster that all the flavors come from. And it's only when you've got multiple clusters, so you might have some red fruits, some black fruits, and some oak, that you have three different clusters that you'd say the wine is complex. So if a wine only has one or two clusters, it can have more than one or two aromas, but one or two clusters that the aromas come from, then we say the wine is simple. Three or more, and you typically say the wine has complexity. So let's have a look at the general categories, primary, secondary, and tertiary. So we'll start with primary. And primary flavors are typically associated with the grape. But more importantly, they often refer to the ripeness of the grape as well. We just need to do a little bit of something a little bit technical here. There's two types of ripeness that the grapes will have. There's what most people think of as sugar and acidity. So as the grapes ripen, the sugar levels go up and the acidity levels come down. And sugar and acidity is really dependent on temperature. Temperature is a huge driver on how quickly things like sugar builds up. Simply because photosynthesis, which creates sugars, is far more efficient at warmer temperatures. Now, there is an upper limit that it can occur, but usually the warmer you go, usually within limits, the warmer you go, the better the photosynthesis is, and the quicker you build up sugars and you lose acidity. But for flavors, the more important thing is a thing called physiological ripeness, or I like to use the word flavor ripeness. And this is the fact that grapes typically transition through a range of flavors as they're going through the final ripening process. So, if you think about white wines, if you picked a white wine quite early, you know, the grapes are ripe, but it's still fairly early days, you might often land up with something like a herbaceous flavor. If you let it ripen a little bit more before you pick it and make your wine, you might land up with a floral flavor, green fruits, citrus, stone fruits, tropical fruits, and then finally you might land up with some cooked fruits, which are overripe fruits. Red wines, they typically go through red fruits, black fruits, and then finally land up with cooked or dried out fruits as well. Now, I'm going to get a little bit technical on you here, but the flavors that you land up in the wine is really a function of the length of time from bud burst to picking. So it's very time-based. Physiological ripeness is based on time, whereas sugar and acidity is based on temperature. Now, the time between bud burst and veraison is like the start of the ripening, the grapes change color and they start to swell. The time between bud burst and veraison is normally pretty set for each grape variety. There is some a little bit of deviation. You know, you can get a few days change here and there depending on the weather, but it's pretty much set by the time from bud burst. And certainly the time from veraison to a particular flavor profile in the grapes at harvest is again pretty much set by time. So physiological ripeness flavors are dependent on how ripe the grapes are and how long it took to get to that ripeness. So things that might make a difference are when bud burst occurs. So for example, in a maritime climate, when you're by the coast, it actually is a lot warmer by the coast in winter, and it doesn't take much of a temperature difference for the temperature to rise enough for the buds to burst and the whole season kicks off. You start the clock at that point. In a continental climate where it's much colder and colder for longer before it suddenly changes and becomes much hotter, is normally after something like a maritime climate, or, you know, all things being equal. So you might expect riper flavors, perhaps, in a maritime climate because they've got a longer start to their season. But the picking time is also really, really important. So picking time can be based on sugars, and it can be also based on flavors or ripeness. But you don't always have a choice on picking time. So for example, if you are a maritime climate, and you're, say, in Bordeaux, it rains coming up to picking, and you don't want to be harvesting your grapes in the rain or just by the rain, because there's all sorts of disease pressures that you can get into and problems with grape quality if you're harvesting with the rain, just after rain or during the rain. So sometimes you might land up picking earlier than you'd really like to because of weather issues. Now, some grape varieties in some regions, you get bud burst, the grapes form, you have Varaisin where it changes, and then there's no pressure from Varaisin when the grapes change colour and the ripening process starts through to when you decide to pick it. You can just choose to pick it at your leisure. There's absolutely no problems. You know, there's no weather issues. You can pick it at exactly the right time you want. So you can always pick on the flavour or the sugar or whatever it is that you're picking on. Some varieties in some regions are actually a lot harder and a lot riskier. So for example, Cabernet Sauvignon in Bordeaux is a little bit right up against the edge. Sometimes at the end of the season, the grapes aren't quite ripe enough that you'd want in some locations. And certainly there's another grape variety grown in Bordeaux called Petit Verdot, which hardly ever ripens fully and gets to the sort of flavours that people are looking for. So the flavour profile you get for each grape is typically to do with how long the physiological ripeness that before the grapes are picked at. Let me give you two examples. Cooler regions with a relatively late bud burst and Varaisin and a short growing season will often have less ripe flavours as the growing season is too short for riper flavours. So if I've got a grape variety that buds quite late and the growing season's quite short for it, I might land up being in the red fruit category rather than in the black fruit or cooked fruits. If you could get those grapes with a longer ripening period or a longer growing season, you could find that you get riper flavours, you know, going from red fruits to black fruits perhaps. Now, if we look at a warm wine region, you might find that bud burst is a little bit earlier because it's warmer, so it gets the temperatures that grapevines start growing earlier in the season. And if it's also a warmer season, it might be warm enough for the grapes to continue photosynthesizing well beyond where you'd normally want to pick them. So you could pick your grapes at, say, red fruits, just like you did in the cooler region, and that wouldn't be a problem. But what happens is, in a warmer region, you'll land up with more efficient photosynthesis, so you'll land up with higher alcohols for the same fruit level. So in a cool region, you might land up with red fruits. In a warmer region, you might pick the grapes early, but because the region is generally warmer, you'll land up with higher alcohols and lower acidities. I suppose what I'm trying to say with this is that the flavours follow a path of ripeness, going from herbaceous, red fruits, black fruits, cooked or dried fruits, or with white wines, they go through that herbaceous, floral, green fruits, citrus, stone fruits, tropical fruits, cooked or dried fruits type of thing. So grapes go through that process. Where they're grown will determine where typically you land up picking your grapes. It could be because you're picking in a warm region because of sugar levels, or it might be in a cooler region you're picking because you want to make sure the grapes reach a certain level of ripeness and or sugar levels, who knows. The other thing is that the flavours that you get in the wine that come from the grapes, they're actually dependent on the grape variety itself. All the grape varieties follow a similar flavour path of ripeness, but some have more distinguished flavours than others. Some even have quite unusual, unique flavours. For example, you get blackcurrant in a moderate to warm Cabernet Sauvignon. You get pepper in a moderate Syrah, or things like gooseberry and passion fruit in a moderate climate Sauvignon Blanc. Do you notice here I'm talking about the climate as well as the grape variety? Because the climate gives you an idea of it. If you've purchased our Level 3 tasting guide, which is quite a handy thing, one of the additional bits of information we give you is we give you the classic WSET flavours for that grape variety, and also we categorise them into the flavours you'd expect from a cooler climate, a warmer climate, a hot climate. So flavours can give you the grape variety, and when you know the alcohols well, and you know the grape variety, then you've got a pretty good idea of the climate that it's grown in, and that can give you a short list of regions. That's one of the things some wine geeks do, is they just look at things like the flavour profile, the alcohols, the acidity, and then they construct, well, this must come from one of three places. They've done this as well, and they've done this as well, so therefore it was probably from this region here. Looking at the colour of the wine, it's this vintage. You know, you can start to see how some people can get quite good at guessing, and it is guessing, what the wines and regions are. One of the things about primary flavours is when you taste the grape, you do not usually get the final flavour in the wine. I don't know if you've ever done this, but if you go to the supermarket, buy yourself some grapes from the supermarket, the grapes sort of taste like grapes. You don't pop them in your mouth and go, wow, I'm getting tropical banana and pineapple and a little bit of red fruits. No, you don't do any of that sort of carry on. Pop a grape into your mouth and it sort of tastes like a bit of sweet nothing, really. And what's going on there is, I'm definitely not a biochemist here, but I do know one of the mechanisms is that a lot of flavors get bound up with the sugar molecules. So you get this aroma, it's sort of chemically tied to a sugar molecule, and so it's such a large molecule, it's not volatile, so it won't go up to olfactory lobe and you won't be able to taste it. But during the process of alcoholic fermentation, what happens is that link, when the sugar's been converted into alcohol, it breaks the link to the flavor molecule, and all of a sudden the flavor molecule becomes volatile. So in theory, really, a lot of the primary fruit flavors you get in your grapes are actually a function of the alcoholic fermentation. But the key thing between, say, primary flavors, which are from the grape, and secondary flavors from some sort of winemaking process, is that the precursors to the flavors, you know, those aromas that are bound up with the sugar, are already in the grape, and they're not added to the wine at a later date or as part of the winemaking process. So they're already there. They're just being released and made available for us to be able to smell. Another thing is that some yeasts are actually better at releasing certain flavors than others, and they can have a huge influence in the style of the wine. A selected yeast strain can ensure a consistent style of wine. While using a large number of yeast strains, such as in a wild fermentation, may lead to more complex aromas, but you may find that it's a little bit harder to unpick what's going on. So you might say, well, it's got a richer note to it, or a richer set of smells, but you can't put your finger on exactly what those smells are. Quite often they smell a bit funky to me, but funky isn't exactly a good word, is it? The other thing is that cooler fermentations can sometimes create strange aromas, such as pear drops. If you do a really cold fermentation, you will get the development of pear drops. And a warmer fermentation can actually result in the loss of some of the lighter, more volatile aromas. A classic one is floral aromas. If you have a warmer fermentation, you'll lose any floral aromas in the wine because they just simply boil out of the wine and they're lost to us to be able to actually smell. So that's your primary flavors. These are flavors that come from the grapes themselves. The process of alcoholic fermentation releases them. And we categorize these flavors often by ripeness, from least ripe to more ripe. And that's to do with the physiological ripeness of the grapes. And that takes time, about where along that physiological ripeness that you land up with. The next one is secondary aromas. And secondary aromas are the ones directly associated with the winemaking process. And the key thing here is the underlying molecule or molecules that give you the aroma weren't in the grape in the first place. And through some sort of winemaking influence, you've added flavor to the grapes. Remember, primary fruit flavors, the molecules already there, we're just releasing them. Whereas in this process, we're adding new flavor molecules to the wine. These fall into three general categories: yeast influences, malolactic fermentation, which we'll talk about, and oak. So let's start with yeast. Wines develop yeasty flavors when they've been in contact with yeast for a reasonable length of time, typically in the order of months rather than the normal days or weeks that you get for. Just because you've got yeast doing a normal fermentation, you don't normally get yeasty aromas. But if you left the wine for an extended period of time on a yeast, whether it be live or dead, you can pick up yeasty-like flavors. For example, bread dough or sourdough is a common description for Pinot Sherries that have had an extended aging in contact with a live yeast known as floor. Short period on the dead yeast, we call this lees aging. It also gives bread dough-like flavors, and these can sometimes be picked up. The most famous wine for that is something like a Muscadet sur Lee, where the wine lies on the dead yeast for 3, 4, 5, even longer months. And during that time, it picks up richness from the dead yeast, and sometimes, not always, but sometimes you do get a sort of a bready dough-type characteristic coming into the wine. Probably the one most people are more used to with yeast is champagnes and traditional method sparkling wines. These wines spend at least 9 months in contact with the decomposing yeast. So it's not just dead yeast, but the yeast is actually starting to decompose in the bottle. And it releases a lot of flavor with flavors like biscuit, bread, toast, pastry, and brioche. This breakdown of yeast we call autolysis, and often we describe those sort of bready flavors as autolic flavors. Just be careful, different grape varieties will have an influence on the autolic flavors. So for example, you know, bread, biscuit, pastry is very classic flavors you'll get from champagnes. But if you use native Cava grapes like Torello and Paralida and Macabeo, you often get a slightly different, more plasticky type smell. And in the Loire Valley, Chenin Blanc, when they've had autolic flavors, often develop a sort of a smoky, toasty type aroma more. So it's definitely yeast, but the influence of the yeast and the wine will create these aromas. The next one that we're going to talk about is malolactic fermentation or malolactic conversion. It's not really a fermentation, but we just call it malolactic fermentation. Some people call it malolactic conversion, whatever. And this is when a finished wine, so the wine's been made, it's finished its alcoholic fermentation, it will automatically be infected with a bacteria known as lactic acid bacteria. Now, this bacteria is everywhere. You can't avoid it unless you do specific things such as fortify it against lactic acid bacteria by keeping the wine cool or using large amounts of sulfur dioxide to kill it off. What the bacteria does is it converts the sharp green apple acid, malolactic, to the softer milk-like lactic acid. So you go from a really sharp green apple to a softer milk-like acid known as lactic acid, malolactic conversion or fermentation, depending on what you want to call it. During that process, you often get these butter and dairy and cream and cheese-like flavors in there. Now, just be careful. Most red wines undergo malolactic fermentation, but you never get these butter, cheese, and dairy flavors. And some white wines undergo it, and you don't get these flavors as well. The grape variety that really shows these buttery characteristics, for some reason, is Chardonnay. Chenin Blanc can also show a little bit of these buttery characteristics as well. But not all wines do show these extra lactic flavors for some reason. I do not know why, but certainly Chardonnay does, and Chenin to a lesser extent also. So not all wines undergo it will exhibit those sort of flavors. The last of the secondary aromas or winemaking aromas is oak influence. Oak has a couple of different influences on the wine. The first thing to note is that oak is actually made up of different species of oak, and different species of oak have different flavors. For example, American oak often has flavors of vanilla and coconut, while the species used in Europe often gives vanilla, cedar, and nut-like flavors. Certainly the size and the age of the barrel can affect how much flavor is imparted. So older barrels give up their flavor quite early on, and then they don't give up any flavor later on in life. And smaller barrels tend to give up lots of flavor quite quickly, and there's a lot of flavor for the amount of wine in a small barrel compared to the amount of flavor given out in a large barrel to a much, much larger amount of wine in the barrel. The other thing you've got to be careful about is when you're making barrels, they often heat the barrels up to help soften the wood to bend it. And that heating up can impart smoky-like flavors into the wines. In fact, even sometimes the sugars in the wood will caramelize and can give you butterscotch-like flavors as well. So smoky, butterscotchy, charred wood-like flavors, quite common for oak barrels as well. And those flavors can come from oak barrels. They can also come from chips and staves, all that sort of thing. One of the effects that oak does also do is when you put wine in an oak barrel, oxygen seeps into the wine. And while the oxygen can be thought of as a winemaking influence, in actual fact, we consider it to be an aged influence, because what's happening is the difference between winemaking influence and what we call tertiary aromas is that tertiary aromas are when the molecules, the flavor molecules in the wine, start to change and the flavor changes as the molecules change. And when we add oxygen to a wine, whether it be through an oak barrel or just over time as the wine ages, sipping through the cork, then that oxygen changes the flavors that are already in the wine and make them into a different flavor. And that's why we sort of say that oak is a winemaker's influence, but the oxidative effect from the oak barrel is a tertiary effect, because it can happen in an oak barrel. It can also happen in a bottle of wine as it ages and oxygen seeps in. So the big difference here is that the oxygen helps to change the flavors that are already in the wine, and therefore we would class them as a tertiary flavor. So no new molecules are added, and the flavor molecules that are already there react with them with each other and oxygen and create new molecules and new flavors. Now, not all wines develop tertiary flavors. Some wines are made in such a way as to be upfront and fruity and may either fade away or develop quite unpleasant flavors that no one really likes. Usually grapes that are exposed to oxygen in the winemaking, particularly before alcoholic fermentation, may lose fruit flavors but will become more stable to longer-term aging. So if you get the grapes and you press them in a basket press and the grapes see loads of oxygen during that process, you'll lose fruit, but the wine will become more stable and be able to deal with oxygen later on in life and develop interesting flavors. Whereas if you try and keep the wine away from oxygen its entire life when it's during the winemaking, it becomes very unstable to oxygen. And as a result, you hold on to lots and lots of fruity flavors, really fun when they're young, but they don't really do much when they get older. Not all wines will develop tertiary flavors. Some will simply fade away or develop unpleasant flavors, and some, depending on how they're made in the winemaking, may develop these interesting flavors. So the first type of tertiary flavor is what we call oxidative flavors, and these are nut-like aromas. So this is the influence of oxygen on the wine, and you'll get things like hazelnut. I see a lot of hazelnut in things like barrel-fermented Chardonnays from Burgundy. You see a lot of that hazel oxidative flavor coming in from those. Walnut, some Olorosos and tawny ports, chocolate and coffee, like an Aussie Shiraz sometimes. And you'll also get toffee and caramel-like flavors as well coming in from oxidation. White wines as they age will not only take on oxidative flavors, the fruit may become less fresh and more dried. And you want to think of things like fresh apples versus dried apples. There's a lack of freshness in the fruit, and that's what one of the things that can happen as white wines age. Sometimes the wine changes in radically different ways that you wouldn't expect. For example, Rieslings quite often develop petrol or kerosene-y notes, while Semillons can sometimes age into toast-like aromas as well. Many whites, and especially the sweeter styles, will often develop honey-like flavors as well. Red wines can develop similar oxidative nutty aromas as white wines, you know, nutty, coffee, toffee, caramel, that type of thing, as well as their fruit drying out. Sometimes we'll say it's a little bit cooked, for example, like cooked strawberries or cooked blackcurrants. But they can also age and develop quite different flavors as well. And these are quite often savory, animal, and earthy. So you might use descriptions like savory or musk, or earthiness, forest floor, leather,